Hi, everyone. How are you all doing? This is a tough hour when we've been listening to interesting things since 8:30, and I bet there's a handful of people in the room who are at a business meeting of some kind at 7 or networking with a colleague over breakfast. So thank you very much for joining us. I want to acknowledge my co-authors, first of all, one of whom is here with us today, Rod Liu. If you can do a shout out, Rod. Rod is the Executive Director of APEAL, which is Asian Pacific Partners for Empowerment, Advocacy, and Leadership. And Jaime Martinez is my other co-author, and Jaime's unable to be here because somebody had to be back in Minnesota doing the day-to-day at Clearway, Minnesota, where he is the Community Development Director. The other thing that I like to point out is, as an evaluator, I feel that my role is to articulate the work of the people that I work with. So this is not my story. I'm presenting it because I've done the methodology, but this is a story of the LAMP fellows who participated in this program. Nothing to disclose. So what is LAMP? In Minnesota, a little bit of background, and it's as we see in most places, we are seeing that we've made a lot of progress in tobacco control. And in Minnesota, the adult smoking rate has decreased to 16%. But unfortunately, we're finding that priority populations are not experiencing that same level of success in reducing rates in many cases. And Clearway, Minnesota did a survey in one priority population in Minnesota this past year that showed smoking rates of 59%. So that's a very dramatic disparity and a very dramatic difference. We also know that the tobacco industry, despite the master settlement agreement, continues to target priority populations and often is able to do some of that work under the radar without a lot of notice from mainstream efforts. So that's some of the underlying background for the creation of the LAMP Institute, which stands for Leadership and Advocacy to advance Minnesota's parity for priority populations. And I'm going to be talking to you today about LAMP 3. This is the third time that the Institute has been implemented in Minnesota, and there's been some evaluation work done on LAMP 1 and LAMP 2. And for LAMP 3, Clearway, Minnesota and APEAL wanted to take that opportunity to really look a little bit more deeply after they'd had the experience of implementing LAMP twice and go a little bit deeper and do a little bit more robust evaluation that built on the past experiences. So one of the things that we wanted to look at is the underlying theory of change from LAMP, and it's organized around five priority population groups, and the idea behind it, the theory of change behind it, is to develop leaders who have the capacity and skills to come from priority populations and work in priority populations, and to develop that work in a culturally sensitive, culturally competent way. I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail of the Institute, partly because Rod covered some of that in another session yesterday, and there is a paper that Rod and Jaime published a few years ago. But the LAMP 3 lasted for 18 months and began in September 2012 and went through March of 2014. There were 18 full days of trainings, and often those trainings were anywhere from 2 to 4 days long, where fellows came together for multiple days to work with each other and to learn skills. And then each of the cohorts of LAMP undertook a community project that they developed and implemented. LAMP is built around five core competencies, and there are additional skills that the fellows learn. But in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on just a handful of those today. But the five core competencies are tobacco control competence, advocacy and leadership skills and competence, cultural competence to work in communities, collaboration, and facilitation. And those competencies should be able to be used in the community, but also to come from the community, and thus the circular nature of the model. So LAMP 3 had 23 fellows in the cohort, and there were 6 fellows from the African immigrant, African American cohort, 3 from the American Indian cohort, 5 in the Asian American Pacific Islander cohort, 6 in the Latino cohort, and 3 in the LGBTQ cohort. We had three main evaluation questions. The first was we wanted to examine LAMP's theory of change and see if we were developing the skills and capacity of the fellows who participated. And then, as we all know, you can have those skills and capacity, but you need to apply those. So we wanted, and you don't do that in a vacuum. So one of the things that we really wanted to look at in this implementation of LAMP's evaluation was, are the fellows, you know, what happens with that information? Are the fellows taking that information out and establishing stronger networks, both within their own priority population communities, across communities, and in the broader mainstream tobacco control movement? And then, of course, the big question, are we starting to make systems and policy change? And I won't be able to, of course, cover all of these evaluation methods today, but we did key informant interviews pre and post with all of the fellows, but also did contact interviews. So fellows identified a contact who was familiar with them and had seen their development over the 18 months of the Institute, and then also did key informant interviews with people that were engaged in the projects or exposed to the projects that the fellows undertook. We did pre and post skills assessment questionnaires so that we could get at that capacity and knowledge piece. And then to look at the networks that the fellows were establishing, we did a social network analysis. I'll describe that in a little bit more detail when I get to it. We also did a lessons learned reflection session. I did participant observations at almost all of the trainings and many of the events. And we're currently doing case studies, putting together case studies of the five projects that each of the cohorts did. So first, the piece of, are fellows learning? Are they developing knowledge and skills? And are they applying those pieces? And with the five core competencies, we found that that was indeed true across all five, that fellows know more at the end of the Institute, and also, just as importantly, they're applying those skills. So I'm going to focus, just for illustrative purposes, just on the tobacco control skill competency and the advocacy competency. But we saw this across all of the competencies, and eventually Rod and I and others will be working on a manuscript that will go into a lot more detail, and we could provide that outside of today's discussion as well. So for this information was gathered through the skills assessment, and this chart shows a scale of 0 to 4, and this is individual knowledge reported by the fellows, and this is averaged across all of the fellows who participated in the Institute. 0 would be having absolutely no knowledge, and 4 would be having a very high level of knowledge, feeling very confident in one's knowledge. And then we asked about a lot of different types of tobacco knowledge. So we didn't just say, do you feel knowledgeable about tobacco control? We asked specific things related to harm from the tobacco industry and from tobacco in priority populations. And you can see that the column on the left is baseline, the column on the right is follow-up, and skills increased. I'm going to go through this a little quickly because it's pretty straightforward. And if you look at advocacy, we saw a similar pattern where skills increase. So that's pretty much, I mean, we would expect that if people are having 18 days of training and spending this kind of time together, we just need to verify that they're indeed developing that skill base. But just as exciting, we started to look then at how often do you use those skills? And again, looking at tobacco, and then we'll look at advocacy for competencies, we have a scale of 0 to 4, but this time the scale is frequency-based. So 0 would be, I've never used that skill. 4 would be, I use that skill very often. And the left bar is pre, and the right bar is post. And you can see across the board, we asked about a number. Again, we broke it down and asked about lots of different ways you might know about tobacco and apply those skills. And we could see that it increased in all the categories. And then with advocacy, you can see that as well. And we really broke advocacy apart, so it included things like, how often have you written a letter to an elected official? How often have you met with an elected official, testified at a hearing? So a lot of those pieces that you break apart when you're doing policy work. So, good news. Fellows are learning. They're feeling like they develop skills. They're applying those skills. What else do they need to be able to implement those skills and be successful advocates for policy? And that was where we wanted to look at whether they were developing networks. And we found that the fellows were developing expanded networks within their own communities, across priority populations, and in the mainstream tobacco control movement. So to look at this, we did social network analysis, and we used a form of network analysis called personal network analysis. And for this, we looked at each individual fellow. So I could show you many, many pictures of each individual fellow, because for every measure we looked at, I have 23 pre and 23 post. And so you can relax. I'm not going to do all of those for today. I'll show you some examples. But so we have that information for each fellow, so we can really tease apart what some of those individual stories are, because not everyone's leadership journey was the same. But then we also did also aggregated the measures so that we can see in general and surmise that across the institute the types of changes that we had. And the type of software that we used for this was called EgoNet, and it's developed by Dr. Chris McCarthy out of the University of Florida in Gainesville, and it's an open source software, so it's actually free to download and use, which you don't hear that about quantitative software very often. So, so if we want to talk in terms of social network analysis measures, these are some of the things that we found. Our average, and these are averaged across all the fellows in the institute. So we had the average degree increased at a lower rate than the average size increased, the average density decreased, closeness decreased, betweenness increased, cliques increased, diversity increased, and influential people and networks increased. Relax, because I know that most of you are like, I don't understand what a lot of these terms mean, so I'll put it in lay language that tells us why this matters. And what we found was that from baseline to follow-up, fellows networks were, first of all, they were larger. And again, we asked people to identify people in their tobacco control network. So the people in their network and in all of this analysis are people that they have developed relationships with who are working in some capacity in tobacco control. And that may be in a paid position, or it may also be somebody who's a volunteer in tobacco control. So this wouldn't include somebody's sibling or the babysitter or a neighbor necessarily, unless they happen to be tobacco control people. So their tobacco control networks are larger, they're more dispersed. So at the start, frequently we would expect to see, you might have a pretty tight-knit network of people that you know that all kind of know each other. So like if we all sit on a committee and work on an initiative together, we all know each other. But maybe they didn't have a lot of contacts beyond a core group they worked with. Well, their networks were more dispersed at the end of the institute. They were also more extensive, so they extended beyond their circles. They included more people that I call influentials or brokers, people that you might see in their network, someone they knew, and that person knew other people, but the two groups didn't know each other. So they had met somebody who had facilitated them making connections to a new set of people. Their networks were less concentrated in one or two professional circles, and they included more people that were perceived by the fellows to be influential in tobacco control. So I'm going to show you a couple examples of pre and post now. And again, I'm going to show you two examples of diversity changing, and then one example of the influential measures, just in the interest of being able to talk a little more in depth about a few things rather than superficially hit a lot of things that leave you a little confused. So what this represents is one fellow, and this is their network at baseline on the left and at follow-up on the right. And to protect confidentiality, I give each fellow a number. So that fellow number 118 just means how I identify that fellow in my record, so that I'm not using the person's name. And it's not like an N. And so all of these little shapes, all of these little dots represent a person, a tobacco control person that is in the fellow's network. So an interview was conducted at the start where they were asked to identify people in their tobacco control network. Who do you know who works on tobacco control? And each of these shapes is what we call a node, and each of those nodes represents an individual that was identified in the tobacco control network. And then the lines between those shapes, the lines between the nodes, means that those two individuals know each other. So one of the things we looked at was how diverse was a fellow's network. And often we might find a situation like the example of this fellow, where at the beginning of the institute, if you look at the little, here we go. I'm going to experiment with the cursor. So these light green five-sided pentagon shapes represent the sector cultural organizations. And so cultural organizations were identified as an organization that focuses on a particular priority population. And so you can see this fellow had a lot of people from culturally based organizations in their network. And then there's one of these squares, the little kind of coral or pink shape there. That's a mainstream tobacco control sector. And then a couple other things. But primarily this fellow's network was composed of people from culturally based organizations, so it might be people that this fellow had worked with prior to the Institute. Now if we go over to the follow-up, first of all, we see the fellow's network is much larger, so they have more people in their network. But now we see there's a lot of new shapes and additional shapes in the network. So these lime green shapes represent elected, either tribal or government elected officials. So this fellow has now developed relationships with elected officials. A lot more of the pink squares, which are the mainstream tobacco control movement, and several yellow triangles, which are people who work in agencies. Now, there are still people from culturally based organizations in that network, but you can see how that fellow's network has really, really diversified and is much richer now. So that's a direction we likely would expect or predict that that a fellow's network might move. But another example of diversity comes from another fellow. This one is fellow 107. And this was a fellow who said at the start of the Institute that they didn't really feel a connection to their own community. And so we saw that this fellow's network changed slightly differently than the example I showed you previously. So this fellow at baseline had a lot of yellow triangles for agency employees, had looks like about five of the pink squares that are mainstream tobacco, a couple of stars which are other, sometimes people from the faith community or business person didn't fit as neatly into our sector classifications, and a few, these little circles, public health. Now if we look at follow-up, And notice there's no little five-sided light green culturally based organization nodes in this fellow's network at baseline. But now at follow-up, we see that indeed there are a number of culturally based organizations, and then also community organizations, which are the light blue squares, a lot of mainstream tobacco commercial tobacco control people, which are the pink squares, and a few public health people. But see how that fellow's network diversified as well, but in a different direction. And this is where we've been very happy that we decided to do a personal network analysis approach, because if we had just done, do you have more people in your tobacco control network, we would have missed a lot of this. Or do you have more mainstream tobacco control people in your network, we would have missed some of these fine distinctions in how fellow's networks changed. So now that you've gotten used to looking at sectors on these nodes, I'm going to switch it up just a little bit for you and give you a slightly different shape. The nodes now still represent people in the fellow's network. So these are still individuals that that person knows in tobacco control. But this time what the circles represent is how influential the fellow believes that the individuals are. And the larger circles, which are kind of a light orange or a tan, represent that a person in their network that the fellow feels are very influential. And then the green ones are quite influential, and the pink ones are really not very influential at all. So you look at baseline then for this fellow, and this person only has one person that they considered very influential in tobacco control at the start of the Institute. But at follow-up, at follow-up, you can see again many more people in the fellow's network, but also look at all of the orange circles that represent that this fellow now has a lot of people that are influential in tobacco control. So that hope that we, that the hypothesis we had that the theory of change would lead to fellows having stronger networks and being more connected, we're seeing examples of that here. So in addition to the network piece, of course, all of this is wonderful, but how does it play out in real terms? Are we changing systems? And the group projects showed that the LAMP fellows were successful at doing just that. So the African Immigrant African American cohort enacted a smoke-free foster care ordinance in Ramsey County in Minnesota. The Latino cohort enacted smoke-free policies in several multi-housing units and also at a couple of churches. The Asian American Pacific Islander cohort passed a smoke-free policy in the Hmongtown Market in St. Paul, which is part of that is an open-air market, so it wasn't covered by the Freedom to Breathe Act in Minnesota. The American Indian cohort is actually still wrapping up their project, and what they did is modeled on the unfiltered report that was put out years ago that exposed tobacco industry tactics. They have taken the tobacco, they're doing additional research with the tobacco industry documents, specifically to exploitation and targeting of the American Indian community, and turning that into a report that can be used for advocacy and policy work. And then the LGBTQ cohort passed a smoke-free ordinance at the Duluth Superior Pride Festival. So a lot of work that went on for a group of people who came in just 18 months earlier and were just on the front end of the learning curve in all of these things. So I think in conclusion, we can say that LAMP's theory of change supported the fellows' capacity and skill development. The fellows obviously very much developed larger and more dispersed networks, including people from the tobacco control movement and people who were elected officials. And fellows were successful at passing policy changes in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area, as well as in outstate areas in Willmar and Duluth and Mankato. So thank you very much for your time. The closing slide, I'd just like to acknowledge there are a number of people who've helped with some of the social network analysis, and our funders, Clearway Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Health, Peel for being so supportive and always providing the information and access that was needed, and of course, the LAMP Fellows most of all. So thank you. I'm sorry, what? Oh, you know, that's a good question. It varies a lot. Rod, are you able to answer that? That actually we haven't... just say 15? Brad, maybe you can talk more about that process. That is based on the fellow's perception, and so there was an interview baseline, and one of the things when you do social network analysis is to really think about if that's the best way to collect the kind of information you need, because it is very time intensive, not just from the evaluation part, but for the participants. And so they had a lengthy interview at baseline and at follow-up where they identified all of those people, and then for each of the people in their network they identified, you ask them a list of questions about the sector, how influential, a couple other factors that we looked at. And then for all of those people, you asked for each and every one of them, do you believe that these two people know each other? So I would say, do you think Jen and Rod know each other? Do you think Jen and Norman know each other? Do you think Jen and Annette know each other? And so if you've got 30 people, 30 times 30, and we gave them an incentive for participating in the interview. So that, but that's how, and it's their perception, because if they don't know that you know Rod, they wouldn't know that you would be a resource to make a connection to Rod. So I guess it's up to you. I'm sorry. Yeah. I pointed.
Do you engage the post-fellowship?
Again, I think that's a Rod question. I would say yes, but Rod can give you details.
Part of any movement in that.
And as a short-term example of successful, I was in the hallway. I ran into a LAM 3 fellow that I didn't even know who was here, who was doing a presentation. And so Shore is here and did not know that. So, and there's another one who... Yeah, so...
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.